Although the chieftain did not understand the words, he understood my gestures. He ordered one of his men to bring the chest across to him. He made them set it down in front of him and opened the lid. He unpacked the chest methodically, examining each separate item. Anything that particularly caught his attention, he held up and asked a question to which I tried to give an answer with signs. He seemed satisfied that, apart from my scalpels, the chest contained no dangerous weapon. I am not sure if he realized at this stage that these were medical items. However, with signs I showed him what I needed to do, pointed to my leg, and made a pantomime of pulling the arrow. He stood over me with the sword in his hand and made it clear that he would lop off my head at the first sign of treachery, but he allowed me to use my instruments. The arrow had entered at an angle and position which made it awkward for me to reach. In addition to this, the pain that I inflicted upon myself as I used the taita spoons to trap and mask the barbs that were buried deep in my flesh brought me more than once to the point of fainting away. I was panting and drenched in sheets of sweat when at last I was ready to draw the arrowhead. By this time I had an audience of half the men in the camp. They had returned to crowd around me and watch my surgery with garrulous interest. I took a firm hold on the handles of the spoons, placed a wooden wedge between my teeth, and bit down on it hard, and drew the clamped arrowhead out of the wound. There were shouts of wonder and amazement from my audience. Obviously none of them had ever seen a barb drawn with such ease and with so little damage to the victim. They were impressed even further when they watched the skill and dexterity with which I laid on the linen bandages. In any nation and in any culture, even the most primitive, the healer and the physician have a special place of honour and esteem. I demonstrated my credentials in the most convincing manner, and my status in the Ethiopian camp was drastically altered. At the orders of the chief, I was carried to one of the tents and laid on a straw mattress. My medicine chest was placed at the head of my bed, and one of the women brought me a meal of cornbread and chicken stew and thick sour milk. In the morning, when the tents were struck, I was placed in a pole litter behind one of the horses in the long caravan and pulled along the rough and precipitous tracks. To my dismay, I saw from the angle of the sun that we were headed back into the fastness of the mountains, and I feared that I was lost to my own people, probably for all time. The fact that I was a physician had probably saved my life, but it had also placed such value on me that I would never be turned free. I knew that I was now a slave in more than name alone. Despite the jolting of the litter, my leg began to heal cleanly. This further impressed my captors, and soon they were bringing to me any number of the band who were sick or injured. I cured a ringworm and lanced a whitlow under a thumbnail. I sewed together a man who had won too much gambling with his quick-tempered friends. These Ethiopians had a penchant for settling arguments with a dagger. When one of the horses threw its rider down a gully, I set his broken arm. It knitted straight, and my reputation was enhanced. The Ethiopian chieftain looked at me with a new respect, and I was offered the food bowl after he had made his selection of the choice cuts before any of the other men were allowed to eat. When my leg had healed sufficiently for me to walk again, I was given the run of the camp. However, I was not allowed out of sight. An armed man followed me and stood over me, even when I was on the most private and intimate business amongst the rocks. I was kept away from Masara, and only saw her from afar at the start of each day's journey, and again when we camped for the night. During the long day's ride through the mountains, we were separated. I rode near the head of the caravan, while she was brought along at the rear. She was always accompanied by her female jailers, and usually surrounded by armed guards. Whenever we did catch sight of each other, Masara cast the most desperate and appealing looks at me, as though I would be able to help her in some way. It was obvious that she was a prisoner of rank and of importance. She was such a lovely young woman that I often found myself thinking of her during the day and trying to fathom the reason for her captivity. I decided she was either an unwilling bride being taken to meet her future husband, or that she was a pawn in some political intrigue. Without a knowledge of the language, I could not hope to understand what was taking place, or to learn anything about these Ethiopians. I set out to learn the Geese tongue. I had the ear of a musician, and I played my tricks upon them. I listened attentively to all the chatter around me, and picked up the cadence and the rhythm of their speech. Very early on, I was able to deduce that the chieftain's name was Akun. One morning after the caravan set out, Akun was giving orders for the day's march to his assembled band. I waited until he had delivered a long and heated harangue, and then I repeated it in precisely the same tone and cadence. They listened to me in stunned silence, and then burst into uproar. They roared with laughter and beat each other on the back. Tears of mirth streamed down their cheeks, for they had a direct and uncomplicated sense of humour. I had not the least idea what I had said, but it was obvious that I had got it exactly right. They shouted excerpts from my speech at each other and wagged their heads, mimicking Akun's pompous manner. It took a long time for order to be restored, but at last Akun strutted up to me and shouted an accusatory question at me. I did not understand a word of it, but I shouted the same question back at him, word for exact word. This time there was pandemonium. The joke of it was too rich to be borne. Grown men clung to each other for support. They screamed and wiped their streaming eyes. One of them fell into the fire and singed his beard. Even though the joke was on him, Akun laughed along with them and patted me on the back. From then onwards, every man and woman in the camp was my teacher. I had only to point at any object, and the Geese word for it was shouted at me. When I began to string those words into sentences, they corrected me eagerly and were inordinately proud of my progress. It took me some time to fathom the grammar. The verbs were declined in a manner which had no relationship to Egyptian, and the gender and plurals of the nouns were strange. However, within 10 days I was speaking intelligible G's, and had even built up a good selection of choice curses and invective. While I learned the language and treated their ailments, I studied their mores and manners. I learned that they were inveterate gamblers, and that the board game that they played endlessly was a passion. They called it dom, but it was a simplified and rudimentary form of beo. The number of cups in the board and the quantity of stones brought into play varied from beo. However, all the objects and the principles were similar. Akun himself was the dom champion of the band, but as I studied his play, I saw that he had no inkling of the classic rule of 7 stones, nor did he understand the protocol of the 4 bulls. Without a thorough knowledge of these, no beo player could aspire to even the lowly 3rd grade of masters. I debated with myself the risk that I would run in humiliating such a vain and overbearing tyrant as Akun, but in the end I decided that it was the only way to gain ascendancy over him. The next time he sat in front of his tent and set up the board, smirking and twirling his moustache as he waited for a challenger to step forward, I elbowed aside the first aspirant and settled myself cross-legged opposite Akun. "I have no silver to wager," I told him in my still rudimentary G's. "I play for love of the stones." He nodded gravely. As an addict of the board, he understood that sentiment. The news that I was taking the board against Akun ran through the camp, and they all came laughing and jostling to watch. When I allowed Akun to lay 3 stones in the east castle, they nudged each other and chuckled with disappointment that the game would be so swiftly lost. 1 more stone in the east, and the board was his. They did not understand the significance of the 4 bulls that I had banked in the south. When I loosed my bulls, they strode invincibly across the board, splitting his unsupported stones and isolating the east castle. He was powerless to prevent it. 4 moves, and the board was mine. I had not even been called upon to demonstrate the rule of 7 stones. For some moments, they all sat in shocked silence. I do not think that Akun realized the extent of his defeat for a while. Then, when it sank in upon him, he stood up and drew the terrible blue sword. I thought that I had miscalculated, and that he was about to lop my head, or at least an arm. He lifted the sword high and then swung it down with a shout of fury. With 12 strokes he hacked the board to kindling and scattered the stones about the camp. Then he strode out into the rocks, tearing his beard and shouting my death threats to the towering cliffs that hurled them onwards down the valleys in a series of diminishing echoes. It was 3 days before Akun set up the board again and gestured to me to take my seat opposite him. The poor fellow had no inkling of what lay in store for him. Each day my command of the Geese language increased, and I was at last able to glean some understanding of my captor and the reason for this long journey through the canyons and gorges. I had underrated Akun. He was not a chieftain, but a king. His full name was Akun Ganuchi Mariam Naguza Nagast, King of Kings, and ruler of the Ethiopic state of Aksum. It was only later that I learned that in this land any mountain brigand with 100 horses and 50 wives was likely to set himself up as a king, and that at any one time there might be as many as 20 kings of kings on the rampage for land and loot. Akun's nearest neighbour was one Prester Beni John, also claiming to be king of kings and ruler of the Ethiopic state of Aksum. There appeared to be a certain amount of ill-feeling and rivalry between these two monarchs. They had already fought a number of inconclusive battles. Masara was the favourite daughter of Prester Beni John. She had been kidnapped by one of the other robber chieftains, one of those who had not yet crowned himself nor taken the obligatory title of King of Kings. In a straightforward trading arrangement, Masara had been sold to Akun for a horse load of silver bars. Akun intended using her to gain political ground from her doting father. It seemed that hostage-taking and ransom were very much a part of an Ethiopian statesmanship. Not trusting any of his own men with such a valuable commodity, Akun had gone himself to take possession of Princess Masara. Our caravan was carrying her back to Akun's stronghold. I gathered this and other information from the gossipy women slaves who brought me my meals, or in casual conversation over the dom board. By the time we reached Amba Kamara, the mountain fortress of King Akun Ganuchi Mariam, I was an expert on the complicated and shifting politics of the various Ethiopic states of Aksum and the numerous claimants to the throne of the empire. I was aware of an increasing excitement running through our caravan as we approached our journey's end, and at last we climbed the narrow winding pathway, no more than just another goat track, to the summit of yet another amba. These ambas were the massifs that made up the mountain ranges of central Ethiopia. Each of them was a flat-topped mountain with sheer sides that plunged like a wall into the valley that divided it from the next mountain. It was easy to see, when I stood at the top of the precipice, how the land was fragmented into so many tiny kingdoms and principalities. Each amba was a natural and impregnable fortress. The man on top of it was invincible, and might call himself a king without fear of being challenged. Akun rode up beside me and pointed to the mountains on the southern skyline. "This is the hiding place of that horse-thief and scoundrel, Prester Beni John. He is a man of unsurpassed treachery." He hawked in his throat and spat over the edge of the cliff in the direction of his rival. I had come to know Akun as a man of not inconsiderable cruelty and treachery himself. If he conceded Prester Beni John as his master in these fields, Masara's father must be a formidable man indeed. We crossed the tableland of the Amba Kamara, passing through a few villages of stone-walled hovels and fields of sorghum and darakorn. The peasants in the fields were all tall, bushy-haired ruffians armed with swords and round copper shields. They appeared as fierce and warlike as any of the men in our caravan. At the far end of the Amba, the path led us to the most extraordinary natural stronghold that I had ever seen. From the main table of the mountain, a buttress had eroded until it stood alone, a sheer pinnacle of rock with precipitous sides, separated from the table by an awe-inspiring abyss. This gulf was bridged by a narrow causeway, a natural arch of stone that joined it to the tableland. It was so narrow that 2 horses could not pass each other on the pathway, so narrow that once a horse started out across the bridge, it could not turn round and return until it had reached the other side. The drop under the causeway was 1,000 feet, straight into the river gorge below. It was so unnerving to the horses that the riders were forced to dismount, blindfold them and lead them over. When I was halfway across, I found myself trembling with vertigo, and I dared not peer over the edge of the pathway into the void. It required all my self-control to keep walking, and not to throw myself flat and cling to the rocks beneath my feet. Perched on top of this pinnacle of rock was an ungainly, lopsided castle of stone blocks and reed thatch. The open windows were covered with curtains of rawhide, and the raw sewage and odious refuse running from the fortress stained and littered the cliff beneath it. Festooning the walls and battlements, like pennants and decorations, celebrating some macabre festival, were the corpses of men and women. Some had hung there so long that their bones had been picked white by the flocks of crows that circled above the abyss, or roosted squawking upon the roofs. Other victims were still alive, and I watched their feeble last movements with horror as they hung by their heels. However, most of them were already dead and in various stages of decomposition. The smell of rotting human carcasses was so thick that even the wind that whined eternally around the cliffs could not disperse it. King Akun called the crows his chickens. Sometimes he fed them on the walls, and at other times he threw their food from the causeway into the gorge. The dwindling wail of another unfortunate victim falling away into the depths was a feature of our life on the pinnacle of Adba Seged, the house of the wind song. These executions, and the daily floggings and chopping off of hands or feet, or the pulling out of tongues with red-hot tongs, were King Arkun's principal diversions when he was not playing Dom, or planning a raid on one of the other neighbouring King of Kings. Very often Akun wielded the axe or the tongs in person, and his roars of laughter were as loud as the screams of his victims.